Good morning.
The title of today's lesson is Celebrated, and it covers chapters 5 and 6 of 2 Samuel. The highlighted verses for today's lesson are in chapter 5, verses 9 through 12, and in chapter 6, verses 12 through 19. The quarterly's author gave the lesson a subtitle of God's works and presence are to be celebrated by His people. I had a couple of three paragraphs here to talk about my father, but I'll just start out by saying he was a great guy. He wanted me to have a good name, and he lived his life so that I would. And I sure am proud of him. Today's lesson. 2 weeks ago, we saw that David had been installed, if you will, as king of Judah in Hebron. He had been anointed king sometime earlier. While David was made king over the two tribes that made up Judah, he wouldn't be king over all of Israel for another 7.5 years. One of the first things David did as king was to send messengers to Jabesh Gilead to praise them for their loyalty and courage they had shown to Saul. The men from Jabesh Gilead had retrieved the bodies of Saul and his sons from the Philistines, who had put them on display after winning the recent battle with the Israelites. David had been genuinely moved by the men of Jabesh Gilead's loyalty to Saul. He wanted to win their support, as he was sure it would help in his efforts to bring the rest of Israel under his kingship. Last week, Joe aptly took us through the last part of chapter 2, chapter 3, and chapter 4. We covered the first part of chapter 2 2 weeks ago. In the remainder of chapter 2 and chapter 3, the events of the war between the house of Saul and the house of David are recorded. Chapter 4 recorded the events surrounding the murder of Ish-bosheth, the only remaining legitimate son of Saul, who had become king of the remaining 10 tribes of Israel, even though he was grossly unprepared for that job. As we move into chapter 5, which is now after the death of Ish-bosheth, verses 1 and 2 tell us, "All the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you're the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler.'" David was made king over all of Israel. Chapters 5 and 6 of 2 Samuel cover a great deal of David's reign in a relatively few verses. 2 Samuel 5:5 tells us that he, David, reigned 7 years and 6 months in Hebron, and then for 33 years in Jerusalem. The first part of this time in Hebron was the period in which he fought the civil war with Ish-bosheth, described in the chapters covered last week. However, the civil war did not take the full 7.5 years, and there's no reason to think that David immediately conquered Jerusalem after the events described in chapter 4. David first had to work out with the 12 tribes the terms for establishing his reign over all of Israel. After this was accomplished, it was no doubt sometime before he was ready to launch an attack on Jerusalem. After taking Jerusalem, he next built a palace and sometime later looked into bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. All of this would have taken several years. This brings us to an important point. The two chapters we're working through today cover a long period of time. During this time, David was a good and successful king. He honored God, defeated Israel's enemies, unified the people, and governed well. A great deal of 2 Samuel is taken up with the sins and failures of David. This tends to present a skewed view of the man. He was a good man and a good king. Clearly, he had faults, as we all do. No doubt, years of power had a somewhat corrupting effect. But David genuinely feared God and sought to do the right thing for the people of Israel. In this short passages, chapters 5 and 6, covering the early years of faithful service, we see something of why David was called a man after God's own heart. As mentioned earlier, at the time of David's conquest of Jerusalem, the city was occupied by the Jebusites, a Canaanite people. At first, as we were told in Joshua 15:63 and Judges 1:21, the Israelites failed to take and hold the city. The Israelites did take the city and burn it, but the Jebusites remained there and rebuilt it. The name Jerusalem is very ancient, predating the arrival of the Israelites. While the Jebusites lived there, Jerusalem was also called Jebus and also Zion. Additionally, the Jerusalem that David conquered was very small. It was the area south of the Temple Mount and west of the Kidron Valley. I wish we had a wall map so that we could point that out. That area, now a tiny part of the whole city, is called the City of David. Nevertheless, Jebus was well fortified and had resisted previous attempts to conquer it. The Jebusites scorned David's efforts to take the city. They claimed that the city was so strong that they could defeat David even if the defenders were lame and blind. Verse 8, just prior to our highlighted verses, seems to say that David's troops gained access to the city by way of a water shaft. But the meaning of the Hebrew is disputed, and the actual means by which he gained access to the city is unclear. What is clear is that David captured Jerusalem and made it his capital. Our first subheading for this lesson is called Recognized, and it covers verses 9 through 12 of chapter 5. Verse 9 reads, David took up residence in the stronghold, which he named the City of David. He built it up all the way around from the supporting terraces inward. Having taken the city, David began new construction projects there. He had two aims. First, he wanted to rebuild and improve the fortifications to make it more defensible. Remember, he had just gained access to the city, so he knew one way it could be done and wanted to be sure there weren't any others. Second, he wanted to make it into a city worthy to stand as the capital of all of Israel. On the northeast corner of the city, he built a series of terraces and retaining walls called Millo, M-I-L-L-O, Millo or Millo, on the hillside. These terraces and retaining walls created a more stable platform for the construction work he planned, including his palace and defensive systems. David called his capital city the City of David. Conquerors and kings often named cities after themselves in the ancient world. History records any number of examples of this. While this sounds like an act of vanity to us, and sometimes it probably was, it also had political purpose. It served to tell the people that a new political era had begun. David was signaling to the Israelites it was that the ancient and previously unconquered Jebusite city had been taken. The dynasty of Saul was over, and David was remaking the political landscape of Israel. Verse 10 reads, David became more and more powerful, and the Lord of God of armies was with him. While verse 10 says nothing specific about what happened, it, no doubt, includes many areas of success. Whatever partisans of the house of Saul that remained submitted to David's authority. David had victory on the battlefield against Israel's enemies. The land enjoyed peace and thus flourished economically. Distant kings recognized David as a legitimate king of all of Israel, and the Israelites were generally optimistic about the future. They were supportive of their new young king. The Bible attributes David's success to God's favor. This implies David was indeed God's chosen and that he was doing the right thing. He was living up to the task God had given him. This also implies that the good times David and Israel were enjoying depended entirely on God's favor, and that could be withdrawn at any time should the king and the people drift into sin. Verses 10 and 11 read, King Hiram of Tyre or Tyre sent favors to David. He also sent cedar logs, carpenters, and stonemasons, and they built a palace for David. Then David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people. Hiram was king of Tyre. Tyre, along with Sidon, was one of the great cities of the Phoenicians. It was located just north of Israel in what is now Lebanon. The Phoenicians created a mercantile rather than a military empire. 1 Kings 9, 26 and 28, and 10, 11 and 12 tell us that these Phoenicians, ships and merchants, went across the known world. The Phoenicians controlled access to the famed cedars of Lebanon and other natural resources. They also had craftsmen that were far more skilled than any in Israel. According to 2 Chronicles 2:1-16, King Hiram of Tyre was closely involved with the construction of David's palace as well as the temple Solomon built. We do not know how David paid Hiram for the material and services he provided, but 2 Chronicles 2:10 tells us that David shipped Israelite produce north to Tyre as compensation. The fact that Hiram was recognized by David as king, the fact that Hiram recognized David as king with whom he could do business testified to David's reputation in the international arena. The rest of chapter 5 and the first part of chapter 6 tell us several facts about David's reign. We were told in verses 13-16 that after leaving Hebron, David took more concubines and wives, and that more sons and daughters were born to him. I thought it was interesting the order in which those two were listed in the Bible. Concubines was listed before wives. Although taking wives and concubines was normal for that time for very rich men, I'm not sure God approved. These verses also record how David defeated the Philistines at Baal Perazim and again at the Valley of Rephaim. As we get into chapter 6, we find David wanting to bring the Ark of God to Jerusalem. The Ark of God was a national treasure of Israel, and it was ordinarily kept in the tabernacle. When the Ark of God was returned to Israel after a brief captivity by the Philistines, it was kept in the home of Abinadab for 20 years. David attempted to bring the Ark to Jerusalem, but had a problem. Before moving on, he had the Ark put in the home of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The Ark stayed there for 3 months. Here's where our second subheading called Honored, covering verses 12-16, picks up. Verse 12 reads, "It was reported to King David, the Lord has blessed Obed-Edom's family and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and had the Ark of God brought up from Obed-Edom's house to the city of David with rejoicing." To understand this section, we must remember something about the history of the Ark. Exodus 40:2-3 tell us that the Ark was to be honored or housed in the tabernacle where it represented the presence of God in the Holy of Holies. After the conquest of Canaan, 1 Samuel 1:13 tells us that the tent of meeting, including the Ark, was set up in Shiloh. The Ark, however, was sometimes away from the tabernacle. Israel's army sometimes took it with them when they went out on a military campaign. They had brought the Ark near to the war with the Philistines, but had lost both the war and the Ark. Subsequently, God struck the Philistines with a plague. For sometimes the Philistines moved the Ark among their cities, but according to 1 Samuel chapters 4-6, they finally sent the Ark back to Israel. For a while, the Ark was at Beth Shemesh, but even that Israelite town was struck with a plague. The Ark eventually ended up in the home of Abinadab. The Ark was neglected during Saul's reign. David seemed to be trying to make the Israelis aware of the Ark's importance to God and Israel. The history of the Ark is intertwined with the history of the tabernacle. As mentioned, Shiloh became the location for the tent, but the city and sanctuary were sacked, apparently after the same battle which the Philistines captured the Ark. The Israelites then had a tent sanctuary at Nob, but 1 Samuel 22:11-22 tells us that this city was sacked by Saul's thug, Doeg the Edomite. The Nob narrative does not mention the Ark, so apparently it was not there at the time. The next tent sanctuary was at Gibeon, mentioned in 1 Chronicles 16:39-43 and 2 Chronicles 1:3-4. Since the Ark was not mentioned there, apparently the tent at Gibeon did not possess the Ark either. This was the situation when David established himself in Jerusalem. The main sanctuary was at Gibeon, and the Ark had been moving from place to place. David wanted to move the Ark to Jerusalem, but abandoned the task when Uzzah, a son of Abinadab, was struck dead by God for touching the Ark with his hand. Angry and afraid because he thought the Ark was inherently dangerous, 2 Samuel 6:9 tells us that David left the Ark at the home of Obed-Edom. 1 Chronicles 26:4 mentioned a Levite named Obed-Edom And so this Obed-Edom may well have been a Levite also. However, contradicting this, 2 Samuel 6:10, just prior to these highlighted verses, calls this guy a Gittite, meaning of Gath, and likely a Philistine, not a Levite. This will tell us that no Israelite was willing to take the ark. We really can't be sure which is correct. 3 months after they had left the ark at Obed-Edom's home, David's men learned that the man had suffered no harm, but he had noticeably prospered. This convinced David that it was safe to bring the ark to Jerusalem. The ark of God was the most sacred object in Israelite life, and David and his people exuberantly celebrated its entrance into the capital city. Verse 13 through 15 read, "When those carrying the ark of the Lord advanced 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fatted calf. David was dancing with all his might before the Lord and wearing a linen ephod. He and the whole house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and sounds of the ram's horn." Verse 13 states that while bringing the ark into the city, they sacrificed an ox and a fatted calf after 6 paces. If they did this after every 6 paces, as some believe, it would have made for a very expensive and slow journey, not to mention a very bloody one. What probably happened is that there was a sacrifice only after the first 6 paces. 1 Chronicles 15:26, discussing this event, does not mention these sacrifices at all. It does tell of the sacrifice of 7 bulls and 7 rams at the end of the journey. Verse 14 states that David was wearing a linen ephod. This was a garment similar to a vest and had great religious significance. The most famous ephod is the one that was part of the vestments of the high priest described in Exodus 28:4 through 8. It was worn over the priest's robe. Ephods were mentioned among other priestly items in several places in Judges and 1 Samuel. This raises the question, how was it that David, a non-Levite, was wearing a priestly garment? It's possible and likely that this reflects the special place of David as king. "It's good to be the king." That was quoted from a line from the movie History of the World, Part 1. As king, there ain't no one who's likely to tell you no. David would inherit a priesthood according to the pattern of Melchizedek, as Psalms 110:4 records. Of course, even Davidic kings did not have full priestly privileges, as Uzziah discovered to his sorrow. In 2 Chronicles 26:18 and 19, we're told that though a king but not a priest, Uzziah was trying to burn incense in the temple, a priestly duty. God struck him with leprosy, and he had it until he died. Likely, David was not claiming to be a full priest. He was wearing this priestly garment as an officiant in a ceremonial procession. Samuel wore an ephod even when he was a little boy, when he was a young sanctuary attendant, and certainly not a full priest. 1 Samuel 2:18 tells us that David wore an ephod when he was going through the inquiring of the Lord. All of this tells us, or suggests, that the ephod was worn by officiants in various ceremonial functions, and it was not exclusively a Levitical priestly garment. David wanted to consolidate the elements of Israel's sanctuary, the tent and the ark, in Jerusalem. This task was still not finished at the time of his death, since Gibeon was still the sanctuary city early in Solomon's reign. According to 2 Samuel 1:3 through 13. But David did get the ark to Jerusalem, as we've just read. He took a leading position in the ceremonial possession of the ark because of his great love of God and because of his desire to have his kingdom identified with the Lord. Verse 16, which finishes out our subheading, or this subheading, reads, "As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Saul's daughter, Michal, looked down from the window and saw the king David leaping and dancing before the Lord. She despised him in her heart." When Michal, one of Saul's daughters and David's first wife, saw David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she spitefully condemned him. David had been dancing vigorously and perhaps wearing little more than a linen ephod, a small and sheer garment. Several places in Psalms tell us The dance was performed in the Israelite temple as part of worship. Other places in the Old Testament tell us that people also danced at various celebrations and religious events. This dancing was not done as couples, i.e. a man holding a woman. Although dancing was practiced even in the temple, references to dancers are sparse in the Old Testament. In addition, in this era, dancing was associated with pagan organistic excess, as described in Exodus 17 through 19. In the New Testament, dancing expresses joy in the parable of the prodigal son. On the other hand, the New Testament records in Mark and Matthew that Herod Antipas was seduced into murdering John the Baptist by a dance. Michal's complaint against David was not entirely groundless. Vigorous dancing, while wearing little clothing, did have pagan implications. But here, context is important. David was not trying to work up an erotic frenzy, but he was expressing how great his joy was that the ark was entering Jerusalem. It was likely that a full set of clothing would have been too hot and too cumbersome for David to allow him to express the joy he was feeling. Michal obviously felt great hostility towards David because of her father, and we learned about that last week from Job. David's violation of decorum only gave her a chance to launch an insult. If she had really loved him, she could have chided him more gently and less publicly to put on more clothes. David's response to Michal probably didn't help the matter. He told her that God had chosen him over her father. This was true, but there was venom in his statement. The argument is not something we should examine as a theological lesson on dancing and worship. It was an expression of a broken marriage. Our last subheading is celebrated, and it covers verses 17 through 19 of chapter 6. Those verses read, "They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent David had pitched for it. Then David offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings in the Lord's presence. When David had finished offering the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of armies. He then distributed a loaf of bread, a date cake, and a raisin cake to each one of the Israelites, both men and women. Then all the people went home." The tent in which they placed the Ark of the Covenant was not the main sanctuary, the tent of meeting or tabernacle. That, as described previously, was in Gibeon at the time. They put the ark in a tent because it would have been unseemly to create a stone sanctuary for the ark while the main sanctuary was still in Gibeon. All the people participated in David's celebration. Burnt offerings were entirely consumed on the offertory fire and thus were eaten by no one. But all worshipers or participants could eat the meat of the fellowship offerings. In addition, people ate bread cakes and cakes made from pressed dates or pressed raisins. In this day and time, they had no refined sugar or candy. So the cakes of fruit were the equivalent of desserts. When I wrote that, I thought about my dessert, which is carrot cake and pecan pies and glorious cheesecakes. And I think that's a lot better than raisin cakes and date cakes. In Hosea 3:1, the Israelites are condemned for their paganism and their love of raisin cakes, indicating that such feasting was also part of pagan worship services. Sweets, in and of themselves, were neither good nor bad. They could well be part of a joyful, holy ceremony. But paganism, by its nature, stresses self-indulgence. So it's not surprising that Hosea seemingly condemned raisin cakes. It is striking that the people joyfully joined David in this celebration, while Michal, David's first wife, spitefully condemned him. Chapter 6 ends with David returning home after the celebration and being ridiculed again by his wife, Michal. David quickly put her in her place when he said in verses 21 and 22, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone in this house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated by my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." Verse 23 tells us that Michal had no children until the day of her death. It would seem that neither David nor God were happy with her. What did we learn from this? God has a plan. God's plan will happen in God's time. Trials and tribulations will never define, limit, or destroy God's plan for us or for anything. We must learn to accept God's timing and remember that Jesus' resurrection has already propelled us to eternal victory. Let's close with a prayer. Lord, thank you for all you do for us. Lord, help us to see your plan in our lives and to yield to that plan rather than try to change it. Help us to be more like you want us to be. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.